This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
To see Long Distance Revolutionary, a documentary about Mumia Abdul-Jamal. This film chronicles his life as a revolutionary, a writer, a journalist, a philosopher, and an inspiration to people worldwide. It's showing June 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. That's a Friday night.
At 7 p.m.
That starts the week-long run of Long Distance Revolutionary in Portland. KBOO is proud to bring you this event, and I hope to see you there.
Wisdom of the Elders is committed to Native American cultural sustainability, multimedia education, and race conciliation. It especially seeks to correct misconceptions and prejudice, to bring health and wellness to Native people, and demonstrate how Indian culture has and is continuing to enrich our worlds. An Evening with Wisdom of the Elders, its second annual gala, is planned for Friday, June 21st, at 6:30 p.m. in the Rose Ballroom of the Ainsworth Event Center in Southwest Portland. The featured guest and keynote speaker will be Deanna D. Dart, Ph.D., curator of Native American art at the Portland Art Museum. Cedar Rose will perform a collaborative musical effort that focuses on traditional and contemporary Native American sounds formed by Karen Kitchen and Nico Wind. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And that's one of the things that constantly surveilling people and constantly communicating to them that they're powerless before this omnipotent government corporate institution does to people. It convinces them that the tiny little box in which they live is really the only box in which they want to live, so they no longer even realize they're being imprisoned. Rosa Luxemburg put that best. She said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains."
That's Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on the Next Alternative Radio. The award-winning journalist and lawyer Glenn Greenwald recently broke the story of NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. Hear Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on Alternative Radio this Tuesday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an interactive searchable database of people associated with secret offshore banking is released to the public.
In light of recently lifting the ban on gay scouts, two Boy Scouts of America leaders are chastised for participating in the Salt Lake City Pride Parade.
And Australia's Great Barrier Reef is listed as endangered by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 17th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. Over 40 demonstrators gathered outside the entrance of the Portland Air Cargo Center of the U.S. Postal Service this weekend. Calling themselves postal protectors, a number of the demonstrators blocked the entrance to the mail processing facility, chanting, picketing, and holding banners that read, "Stop privatization of the People's Postal Service," and "Save family wage, union jobs," the protesters challenged the subcontracting of postal jobs to private contractors. For more, KBOO's Jyoti Pula spoke with Jamie Partridge, a retired postal worker who helped organize the protest.
So this is a national issue. What are the specifics related to Oregon? What is the Oregon issue here?
Okay. In Oregon, the as part of this national phenomenon, mail processing plants are being closed, post offices are having their hours reduced, and more recently in Portland, trucking and mail processing and mail handling are being subcontracted. We just lost the Salem mail processing plant, 100 jobs, 100 family wage union jobs went away, and the machines are being moved to Portland, and there's not room in the postal mail processing facilities here in Portland to handle all the machines from Salem, so they're moving some of them into a private facility. And coincidentally, at the same time, the jobs to work those machines, the mail handling and mail processing jobs, are being subcontracted to a private company.
So in your press release about the action that happened on Saturday, you've kind of declared a victory against privatization. So what was the action about, and what was this victory that you're talking about?
Well, we had about 40 folks out there at the Portland Air Cargo Center, which is the Postal Service mail processing plant at the Portland Airport. And 10 of us blocked the entrance to the facility to prevent the private contractor truck from coming to handle the people's mail. What happened, we were there for almost 3 hours, was no truck arrived. And there would have been three runs of trucking to that facility and out from that facility within that time. And what we found out from workers inside was that management announced that no trucks were going to be going into or out of that facility because of protests. So we actually disrupted the privatization process, the privatizers, for that period of time, and realized that postal management was vulnerable to our protests. So we see this as a campaign. We see that the postal management is making decisions locally, even though this is part of a national trend, and that if we step up the pressure in various ways, disrupt the process, we expect postal management will reverse their decision, bring the trucking jobs and the mail processing, mail handling back in-house, back to postal workers, and ensure the survival of the postal service and good service for the American public.
So what is next in your in this fight?
Well, I can't tell you specifics, except that we're planning a series of tactics to build public support and confront postal management. We were surprised that there were no truck arrived. We found out from the police that they had monitored us online, that they actually found out about the protest ahead of time through the internet, which is a little scary, but it just means that we have to be more secretive about what we're going to do. If we are, that's at least the next action will be won't be public until it happens. But we do expect to, at some point, call on postal management to have a community meeting to explain to us their reasons for contracting now trucking to a company that is in bankruptcy, a no-bid contract, a company that owes the Postal Service $300,000 and doesn't even have its own trailers or trucks. The Postal Management and Postal Service is paying, is providing the trucks and the trailers and the gasoline and paying the company $59 an hour for this trucking that could be actually done cheaper by postal employees.
So how do you want people to be involved in this?
We hope folks will get in touch with Portland Communities and Postal Workers United, and they can get a hold of us by calling 503-752-5112.
That was retired postal worker Jamie Partridge speaking with KABU's Jyoti Pula. Full disclosure, Jamie is also a KABU volunteer with Labor Radio. The number, again, for more information on the postal worker's struggle against privatization is 503-752-5112.
As the Oregon State Legislature approaches the end of its session later this month, a bill that would remove Portland State University and the University of Oregon from being governed by a state education board appears to be headed for the dustbin. The bill, SB 270, was introduced in January, but has been going back and forth between committees since then. In May, it looked as though the bill was going to pass, but as other colleges and universities put in their own bids for autonomy, the bill began to stall. Currently, the Oregon State Board of Higher Education governs the 7 universities in the Oregon State system. But Portland State University and the University of Oregon, the 2 largest universities in the state, have tried to get out of the system and hire their own local governing boards. They say that this will allow them to get more private donors, but critics argue that it sets the stage for privatization of Oregon's public universities. University engineer Mark Wisenfeld and Kurt Wilcox with the Service Employees International Union testified at the last public hearing held by the state legislature on the bill on May 29th.
We suggest to you today that none of us can afford autonomy and independence if it means losing the public's trust in our work and your oversight of their resources and tuition dollars. The legislature cannot allow the spinning off of these institutions without accountability, and we ask that you, Oregon's elected legislature, continue in that role going forward.
As former Representative Tony Van Vliet recently stated in a letter to the Corvallis Gazette Times, Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120, quote, throw the entire university system back to 1929, when overzealous boards of regents fought for over scarce funds and legislators rushed to form a system. I ponder why no one in the legislature hollers, enough.
That was testimony questioning a bill promoted by the administrators at the University of Oregon and Portland State University to remove those universities from the statewide system of governance. The bill remains in a subcommittee and appears unlikely to pass before the state legislature wraps up its session on June 28th.
The Oregon State Senate failed to pass the $6.75 billion school budget this morning. 2 motions to return the bill to committees also failed. A school budget of some kind must pass the legislature before they adjourn on June 28th. Legislators who voted for the bill made impassioned appeals on the floor, saying the school districts needed the money to reduce class sizes and increase the number of school days.
For a decade, the amount of money that we spend on K-12 as a percentage of the overall budget has gone down. What does that say about our priorities? Colleagues, what does that say about our priorities? The results are well known of that disinvestment. Near largest in the nation in class sizes, short school years, and academic results that are mediocre at best.
Colleagues, I've been visiting the schools in both my school districts, Ben Lapine and Redmond. I will sound like a broken record. We have class sizes. I've seen class sizes of more than 50 kids. I've seen elementary class sizes of more than 35, pushing 40.
Colleagues, I was a public school teacher in Oregon and Washington State. I've worked in somewhat large city school districts, but I've also worked in very rural areas. Having worked within a really tight budget in my department, I can tell you that the better school budget is the budget that results in better outcomes for students, the budget that prepares students for the 21st century and provides more learning opportunities. Better outcomes mean we need more teachers, smaller classes, more school days, new curriculum, and technology. This motion allows us to make a bigger step toward that goal, so I ask for your aye vote.
These appeals did not convince the legislators who said that the bill will not address the problems faced by Oregon public schools and voted no.
Thank you, Mr. President. I oppose the motion on the floor. Parliamentary tricks aren't going to get us there as much as I want to see a deal, and I've made that really clear to everybody. Making a motion to send a bill back to a joint committee, so it would require the cooperation of the House as well, for the purpose of putting in the bill an appropriation that is unfunded, because we don't have a deal yet, is not going to get us there.
Democrats currently hold a 16-14 majority in the Senate. The bill failed on straight party lines, with 14 Republicans voting for it, 15 Democrats voting against it, and Democratic Senator Alan Bates from Ashland abstaining. The bill now returns to the senators who introduced it for reconsideration.
The city of Portland wrapped up its Gay Pride Week with a parade yesterday that focused on marriage equality. A Supreme Court decision on the issue did not come through today, but is expected later this week or early next week. Meanwhile, at the Salt Lake City Gay Pride Parade this year in Utah, two local Boy Scout leaders showed up in uniform to participate and may lose their positions as a result. The Great Salt Lake City Council of the Boy Scouts of America say that the two men, Peter Brownstein and Neil Whitaker, broke the organization's rules by advocating for a political message and asked them to apologize. Council leaders stated that they were disappointed the men were trying to use scouting to advance the gay agenda. Brownstein and Whitaker maintained that they had no political message and were simply there to participate in the parade. They have both refused to sign letters of apology. Boy Scouts of America leadership say they don't take issue with the men participating as private citizens, but with the scout leaders wearing their uniforms while in attendance. A spokesman for Boy Scouts of America said that disobeying a rule that you disagree with sets a bad example for youth.
This morning, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that could alter or reaffirm 40-year-old legal protections against housing discrimination. The Opportunity Agenda issued a statement in response, urging the court to reaffirm the bedrock principle that all unjustified practices that exclude Americans from housing based on race, religion, or other characteristics violate the Fair Housing Act. The Act has never been limited solely to cases of individual intentional bigotry. Modern obstacles to fair housing take sophisticated forms, and the Act was intended to address new challenges as well as old ones. Every Court of Appeals to consider the question, as well as the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, has agreed with this conclusion. In the case in question, the township of Mount Holly targeted a predominantly minority neighborhood for demolition and replaced with housing that would have priced most residents entirely out of the locality. According to community members, the township government ignored other approaches that would have been both less disruptive to the community and less discriminatory.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. On tonight's show, they discuss House Bill 3194, the prison reform bill currently before the Oregon legislature. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly sunny and partly cloudy earlier in the day, with scattered showers throughout the afternoon, highs near 67 degrees. Rain is anticipated in the evening, lows around 55.
It's 5:17. It's time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's good to know that our friendly uber-secret National Security Agency is out there every day protecting our freedom by violating it. A whistleblower has literally blown the lid off NSA's 7-year super snoop program of rummaging electronically through about a billion phone calls made every day by us average Americans. This revelation even prompted Al Gore to tweet, "Is it just me, or is secret blanket surveillance obscenely outrageous?" It's definitely not just you, Al. This latest explosion of the Fourth Amendment is so mega awful that authorities had to invent a new word for the process: metadata mining. Most shocking, however, is the tin-eared "who cares" reaction by both Republican and Democratic leaders to this outrageous meta-surveillance of our private lives. For example, GOP Senator Lindsey Graham blustered that, "It doesn't bother me one bit that NSA has my number." Hey, Lindsey, it's not your number we're worried about. It's NSA's collection of our entire country's numbers. Then came Senator Saxby Chambliss. "We have not had any citizen who has registered a complaint," he blathered. Hello, Senator Clueless. No one knew to complain since y'all kept the program secret from us. And President Obama was even more ridiculous. He tried to rationalize his wholesale invasion of our privacy by declaring that Congress knew about the program, as did a special spy court that routinely reviews and blesses it, so it's all legit. In a perplexed voice, Obama said, "If people don't trust the White House, Congress, and federal judges, then we're going to have some problems here." This is Jim Hightower saying, gosh, sir, we the people have now learned that all three branches of government have furtively conspired for 7 years to violate our privacy. So, no, we don't trust any of them. And yes, that is a big problem. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
President Obama made a statement today reiterating his support for the widespread spying on email and online postings conducted by the National Security Agency and revealed last week by whistleblower Edward Snowden. But the NSA spy scandal has cost the president in the polls. His support levels are currently at an all-time low, with many people pointing to the NSA spying as the reason they've dropped their support for the president. At the same time, numerous polls have shown that most Americans do not approve of the NSA reading their emails and other online data. For more, I spoke earlier today with Mark M. Jacox, a policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF. So, first of all, polls are sort of notorious for being easily skewed or not really accurately representative of general public opinion. What makes this recent batch of polls that indicate that the majority of Americans disapprove of the NSA's tactics different?
Well, part of it are the questions that are asked. So it was a kind of interesting. What you described is kind of exactly what happened in the first week. The first poll that was released used inexact language and exaggerated a little bit, and it was the Pew poll, and it said that 56% of Americans found the NSA domestic spying, quote, acceptable, end quote. And within a few days after that, more polls were released by Gallup and CBS and Rasmussen that had indeed said the opposite thing. It was anywhere from 53 to 58 to 59% that Americans actually dislike the NSA spying. And so what you really get down to is how they word the questions. And it does, when you look at kind of how they did the questions and how they asked the questions, the Gallup and the CBS and the Rasmussen polls asked a much more balanced question, included more information about the topic for a fuller informed opinion on the matter.
So what exactly was the wording, or do you know some of the questions that were asked by Gallup or Rasmussen, or the ones that...
Yes, the Pew poll emphasized terrorism investigations and emphasized that the government obtained secret court orders to do this. And we recently found out that initially they have a secret court order, but then they can also retrospectively not have a court order to search these things. So it was a very interesting poll to see. You know, we believe that kind of the emphasis on terrorism generally lets you slide a little bit in the polls, whereas the Gallup poll, the CBS poll, and the Rasmussen poll did include the fact that these were used to investigate terrorism, but they didn't skew it towards emphasizing that terrorist aspect. The polls that came out showing that, according to the polls, Americans are against the NSA's massive surveillance and domestic spying were much more neutral.
So were you surprised by the results?
Well, I was certainly surprised by the Pew poll, because there's a pretty strong history of Americans being skeptical of these government programs. And I don't think you really need to rely on polls for that, because it's history repeating itself. We've seen in the past the NSA consistently abuse legal standards and consistently manipulate legal rationale to justify these programs and to start these programs. So the first poll was surprising, but the later polls weren't surprising at all, because history-wise, Americans have always been skeptical of these mass surveillance and mass searches of things and individuals and communications.
Do you anticipate much reaction from the administration?
Well, there isn't a lot of reaction right now. I think there's still thinking through what is going on, because the American people still don't know exactly what's going on. We have a sense of what these programs are and what these programs do, but we still don't know how they work specifically, what is going on with them, how long the information is kept for. We've heard 5 years for some information, but they've been very, very cloudy on estimates. I think everyone is trying to see what else is going to come out. What is really needed is more information on these programs, because we can have these polls that say Americans do reject wholesale NSA domestic spying, but the American public and democracy itself really demands a dialogue about what is going on and how it's working.
So if people want more information just based on what is available, is there anywhere that you would direct them?
Well, right now, I mean, the EFF, our website, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we've tried to put together a large collation of What has been described in these slides and the documents that have recently been revealed? We also have lawsuits dating back to 2006 about these very exact things. So that is a pretty fantastic resource that has an overview of as much information as we know. In the 70s, after Watergate, the government created this committee called the Church Committee, and it investigated Watergate and uncovered mass domestic spying by the NSA. And so we're calling on a similar action so that the American public can get more information, and even congressmen. EFF.org is our website, and we are further encouraging Congress to push for more hearings, investigations, and committees to look into what exactly is going on. Democracy demands it, and the American public really needs answers to what is being done in our name when it comes to spying on our fellow citizens and spying on foreigners.
Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, no problem. It was my pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Mark M. Jaycox, a policy analyst for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This is Serena Fong with KBOO News.
Delegates from Russia, South Africa, and Turkey, who've learned their communications were monitored during London's G20 summit in 2009, are demanding an explanation from the United Kingdom. According to The Guardian, the disclosure is part of the information released by the National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden. The report indicates it was a senior official from the government communications headquarters that ordered the spying, and the information collected was forwarded directly to then-Prime Minister Gordon Brown's advisers. The government communications headquarters is Great Britain's government agency analogous to the NSA. These revelations come at an inconvenient juncture, with the British government hosting the G8 summit in Belfast, Ireland, which started today.
Leaders of the G8 countries have begun a two-day summit in Northern Ireland to discuss contentious global economic policies. Today at the summit, the decision was made to move forward with a groundbreaking free trade agreement between U.S. and the European Union. UK Prime Minister David Cameron says this will add £80 billion to the U.S. economy and £85 billion to the world economy. The main focus of the talks this evening is the disagreement between the U.S., European Union, and Russia regarding the conflict in Syria, which has left 93,000 people dead in the last 2 years. Russia has openly opposed U.S. plans to arm the Syrian rebels, while it continues to supply arms to the Assad regime. Both sides are meeting for the first time about this issue at the summit to try and find common ground. Meanwhile, thousands of people gathered outside the posh golf resort venue housing the summit to protest against the G8 policies. The Irish Congress of Trade Unions is spearheading the protests, saying free trade agreements are not only damaging local economies, communities, and the environment, but are increasing inequality, hunger, and poverty throughout the world.
Friends of the Earth International conducted a study of 182 people from 18 different European nations and found trace amounts of the herbicide glyphosate in all of them. All test subjects lived in metropolitan areas and had not handled glyphosate products prior to the test. U.S. biotech company Monsanto is the biggest producer of this herbicide, which is marketed in the brand name Roundup. Glyphosate is used worldwide, particularly on GMO crops. Lisa Archer of Friends of the Earth US states that the presence of glyphosate in European populations was particularly troubling because, unlike the US, which grows vast amounts of glyphosate-resistant crops, it is unclear where the traces in European foods are coming from. As of 2010, 70% of all corn grown in the United States has been genetically modified. Just last month here in Oregon, a strain of genetically engineered glyphosate-resistant wheat was found. This product was developed by Monsanto, but was never publicly marketed or approved by the FDA. The spokesman for Friends of Earth Europe, Adrian Beb, says, "Finding this weed killer in people's urine suggests that we are being exposed to glyphosate in our everyday lives, yet we don't know where it is coming from, how widespread it is in the environment, or what it is doing to our health."
Australia's Great Barrier Reef has been listed as endangered by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. The body establishes and assesses the protection of World Heritage Sites and meets this week in Cambodia. The group will consider whether a range of World Heritage Sites should be placed on the in danger list for next year.
The announcement comes as the Australian federal government rejected a moratorium on new port developments in Queensland. The moratorium had been recommended by Australian Greens in order to protect the Great Barrier Reef, at least until 2015, when a new review will take place. The Australian government says it is committed to protecting the reef and has devoted $200 million to the cause. But the failure to pass a moratorium on port development led the United Nations agency to say that Australia is not taking sufficient measures to protect the Great Barrier Reef.
The Turkish government has threatened to use the military to halt a general strike that has followed the police crackdown on protesters in Istanbul. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan claimed that the protesters had been hijacked by what he called terrorists, saying that they would not be allowed to continue. The Turkish Medical Union reports that 4 protesters have been killed and 5,000 injured after 2 weeks of unrest in the country. Tear gas and water cannons have been used to disperse the protesters. Today's general strike was called by unions representing approximately 800,000 doctors, dentists, and engineers.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, or ICIJ, has released an interactive searchable database of names and connections of people associated with secret offshore banking. After spending more than a year compiling the data obtained from more than 2.5 million documents, the ICIJ has now made the information available to the public. The ICIJ notes that the information has been released undoctored, with duplicate records deleted and some overly invasive information, such as passport pictures, withheld. The ICIJ has made a call to anyone from the public to search the data and help the ICIJ continue to report on the various connections and other clues held within. To see the database, which is available to download in its entirety, go to www.icij.org.
The prosecutors in the case of convicted Portland Christmas tree bomb plotter Mohammed Mohammed have asked for a delay in his sentencing. The 21-year-old defendant was scheduled to be sentenced on June 27th. Prosecutors filed a motion today asking for a delay of 2 to 3 months to prepare sentencing recommendations. Mohammed was found guilty in January of plotting to detonate a bomb at Portland's Christmas tree lighting in late November of 2010. He was targeted by FBI agents who acted as members of Al-Qaeda, recruiting him and pressuring him to take violent action. Despite the heavy involvement of the FBI in this case, a jury rejected the defense argument that the then 18-year-old was entrapped by FBI agents. He was found guilty of attempting to detonate a weapon of mass destruction and could face life imprisonment or the death penalty.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, June 17, 2013. Israeli troops raid East Jerusalem and kidnap 40 Palestinian men, and settlers attack a Palestinian old lady. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army kidnapped on Monday 40 Palestinian home and shop owners from occupied Jerusalem, allegedly for overdue taxes. Local sources reported that the Israeli army and police forces invaded Shu'afat refugee camp and Beit Hanina area in East Jerusalem. The Israeli army accused the kidnapped men of not paying taxes for the Israeli Jerusalem municipality. In the past 24 hours, the Israeli army has kidnapped 100 Palestinian men for overdue taxes, local sources added. Staying in Jerusalem, 3 Israeli settlers attacked an elderly Palestinian woman in Deir Yassin area in West Jerusalem. Medical sources said that Fathiya Muhammad Ajaj, 75, was visiting her son, Abid, at a hospital in the area. The woman left the hospital and was waiting for a car to take her home when 3 Israeli settlers beat, kicked, and threw her onto the ground. The settlers also verbally abused her in addition to shouting death to Arabs, before tearing part of her dress off before she lost consciousness. Later on, an aged Israeli bus driver and two young men took her to her home in Jabal al-Mukabbir in East Jerusalem. Elsewhere, eight Palestinian political detainees held by the Israeli army in Rimon detention facility announced on Monday an open-ended hunger strike. The detainees are demanding that the Israeli army move them to detention facilities closer to their families' homes so they can come and visit them, the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society reported on Monday. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 17th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jyoti Pula, Robin Ryan, and Angelique O'Rourke. The producer is Serena Fong. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, host Joe Uris leads a discussion of the former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden and his leaking of top-secret documents disclosing extensive U.S. surveillance of telephone calls and internet communications.
At 9, on Alternative Radio, Guardian newspaper columnist Glenn Greenwald speaks on the security state. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts presents the documentary A New Way of Life and the New Underground Railroad, making a break for freedom during the era of mass incarceration. And at 11:30, on Art Focused, host Ava Lake speaks with Heidi Kirkpatrick about her photo-based work, including straight prints, plus boxes, constructions, and all kinds of assemblage. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Angelique.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 17th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Military tribunals at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center were back in session today to hear the cases of five men accused of plotting the 9/11 terrorist attacks, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. According to longtime Gitmo reporter Carol Rosenberg, the accused do not appear to be participating in the ongoing hunger strike at the facility. Many of the hunger strikers have never been charged with a crime at Guantanamo. Rosenberg reports that as of the weekend, the military continues to force-feed 44 hunger strikers. In Canada, the mayor of Montreal was arrested early this morning on corruption charges. The dramatic arrest comes in the midst of a mayoral election campaign, as well as a large-scale corruption inquiry in the province of Quebec. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
The mayor of Montreal, Michael Applebaum, was arrested at 6 a.m. local time today and is currently in provincial police custody. He is facing 14 criminal charges, including fraud, breach of trust, conspiracy, and municipal corruption. Applebaum, an interim mayor, replaced former mayor Gérald Tremblay after the latter resigned in November amid accusations of corruption. Recent evidence suggests that both the Applebaum and Tremblay administrations channeled government funds towards local organized crime groups with front operations in the construction industry. A Quebec-wide public inquiry, led by the Charbonneau Commission, is currently underway to investigate political corruption allegations. The commission is set to release its final report in October. Meanwhile, Montrealers will go to the polls in November to elect a new mayor. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
Texas Governor Rick Perry vetoed 26 different bills Friday evening passed by the Texas legislature during its latest session. Among them were bills to ensure equal pay protections for women and reforms to the Texas Ethics Commission, which enforces state campaign finance laws. FSRN's Teddy Wilson reports.
Governor Rick Perry cited burdensome regulations on business in his veto of the Texas version of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The legislation would have made it easier for women in the state to sue employers for pay discrimination. The bill, which was opposed by business interests and corporate lobbies, would have changed Texas law from allowing women to sue a business 180 days after their first unfair paycheck to 180 days within any unfair paycheck. Perry did sign into law a bill which requires applicants for unemployment benefits to submit to drug testing upon suspicion determined by responses to a pre-screening questionnaire. When Florida implemented drug testing for welfare recipients, a study found that it resulted in no direct savings, caught few drug users, and had no effect on the number of welfare applications. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, College Station.
The city of Chicago suffered another weekend of gun violence. The Chicago Tribune reports 8 dead and 47 shot. The Chicago Sun-Times, which reported a slightly lower count, called Father's Day weekend the city's most violent of 2013. Two of the dead, including a 15-year-old boy, were shot by police officers. According to photos available on the Sun-Times Homicide Watch page, the vast majority of fatal shooting victims are young, Black and Latino males. And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Many across the country are closely watching the U.S. Supreme Court in the final days of its term, waiting for major decisions on voting rights, same-sex marriage, and affirmative action. Today, the High Court issued a number of other opinions, including one dealing with tactics used by pharmaceutical companies to keep generic drugs out of the marketplace, and another that gives juries more say in deciding mandatory sentences. We're going to take a closer look at two other decisions today. In the case Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona, the court struck down certain voter registration requirements. And in Salinas versus Texas, the court ruled on a suspect's right to remain silent. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Genevieve Salinas voluntarily went to a Texas police station in 1992 to give information about a recent murder under investigation. He refused to answer one of their questions, but did not specifically say he was invoking his right to remain silent. And since it was not an arrest, police never read him his Miranda rights. He was later put on trial for the murders, and his silence was used in court as evidence of his guilt, leading to a conviction and a 20-year sentence. In a narrow 5-4 ruling on Monday, the Supreme Court upheld this conviction, saying that Salinas and others questioned by police must invoke their Fifth Amendment rights in order to avoid self-incrimination. In a concurring opinion, Justices Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia went even further, saying that even if Salinas had invoked his rights, they don't apply in a pre-arrest setting. But constitutional attorney John Whitehead with the Rutherford Institute, who submitted an amicus brief on this case, said the court needs to better define what constitutes an arrest.
The police, in my opinion, were being very sneaky. And they do this in other cases that we've seen where they say, just come down to the police station, let's do an investigation. And there you are, alone by yourself and a number of police, and you're being questioned. At that point, I think your Fifth Amendment right to against self-incrimination and your right, again, to be Mirandized should kick in. They did neither here. So what this opinion does, it undercuts the right to receive, you know, the Miranda warning that anything you say can be held against you. And if you refuse to cooperate, that can be used against you as evidence of guilt, which to me is insane.
Whitehead and other legal experts said the burden should be on police to remind people of their rights, not on those dealing with the police who may not know their rights or not remember them during a stressful or intimidating interaction with law enforcement. Attorney Craig Singer, who represented the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in another amicus brief on this case, also took issue with the majority's finding that Salinas didn't properly claim his Fifth Amendment rights.
It seems pretty straightforward that if you do not speak, then you are exercising a right not to speak. If you were to analogize it to some of those other rights, like the right to free speech, the right not to have cruel and unusual punishment, I mean, you name it, right not to have your liberty taken without due process of law, I mean, typically you don't have to say I'm invoking that right.
The High Court's justices also ruled 7-2 that Arizona's Proposition 200 violates the federal national voter registration law by requiring additional paperwork proving citizenship for registering to vote in federal elections. The federal form, created by Congress in 1993 to make registration as easy and accessible as possible, only requires that voters sign a statement under oath that they have U.S. citizenship. Lead plaintiff Jesus Gonzalez tried to register in Maricopa County the day he became a naturalized citizen, but was rejected for not having the proper documents. In the majority opinion, the court reminded Arizona that it had the right to ask the Federal Election Assistance Commission for permission to change its voter registration forms, but failed to do so. Nina Perales with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, the group representing Gonzalez and other Arizona voters in the case, had a theory on why the state chose instead to take this lawsuit to the Supreme Court.